This is Central Time. Now we are officially in fall, and for some people, i.e. me, that often means sneezing, sniffling, coughing, scratchy throat, itchy, watery eyes. In normal times, you could chalk that up to fall allergies. But how do you know it's not COVID-19 or a cold? Health experts say the cold is coming back now that people are getting together again and not always wearing masks. And that flu, virtually non-existent last year, it is also likely to return. The overlap of symptoms may have you fearing for the worst every time you feel a little bit off. So how do we know what we're dealing with and when we should call a doctor? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you typically have allergies this time of year? Do you immediately start wondering if you have COVID the moment symptoms appear? Does that overlap stress you out? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Dylan Timberlake is an allergist and immunologist with Prevea Health in Chippewa Falls. Dr. Timberlake, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thanks, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
I'm guessing in your line of work, you hear the same question that's been in my mind a lot. What are these symptoms? Is this allergy? Is it COVID? Somewhere in between? How often do you get that kind of question?
Right. So obviously, as an allergist, I get that question quite a bit. And so the way to kind of address it is there are definitely symptoms that overlap between allergies, colds, and COVID. Those are going to primarily be symptoms of the nose. And so, you know, with allergies and colds and COVID, you can get a runny nose, you can get a congested nose. Some of that mucus can drain down the back of your throat, causing a cough. The big differences that I kind of focus on between allergies versus a cold or COVID, and colds and COVID have a lot of overlap, is typically there's going to be other symptoms that you can see with COVID and colds. And so something like fevers, you shouldn't see with your seasonal allergies. You can get a little bit of an upset stomach, but if you really have significant nausea, vomiting, you're not going to see that with allergies. And so really with allergies, you're talking nose and eye symptoms, and you shouldn't see a whole lot outside of those symptoms.
How bad has the fall allergy season been so far around Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's definitely been a pretty bad season. So in the fall, we see weed pollens like ragweed, and it's been a pretty bad season already. And so we're definitely seeing a lot of bad allergy symptoms.
I have been feeling that myself. What is it going to get worse or better usually this time of year from late September and on?
That's a great question. So ragweed and other weeds are pollinating right now. And so it's going to kind of be a stable season, I would expect, through about the first frost of the year. Once we really get a good frost, the pollen counts typically will start to drop off.
When people have a mixed bag of symptoms, when should they be seeking medical help? They're worried it's something more serious. What is the red flag or two that you suggest people watch out for?
Right. So when you're trying to differentiate, should I seek help? Should I get tested for COVID? Should I be worried about a cold? My by and large message is we should always err on the side of being overly cautious and assuming that this is COVID, assuming that this is a viral infection until proven otherwise. The other thing that really helps out is, you know, people can develop allergies throughout their life. That being said, most people who have suffered from allergies are going to be suffering from it for multiple years. And so if you're someone who year in, year out are having these allergy symptoms, and this is your typical time of year that you get them and you're starting to develop them again, yes, that is probably allergies. That being said, if these are new symptoms for you, even if they're new symptoms for this season, right? If we were in the beginning of the season, you're starting to get those symptoms. I advise people if you have a new runny nose, if you're newly congested, if you're having any of those symptoms, it's probably best, at least at the beginning of those symptoms, to go ahead and get that COVID test to make sure that we're not dealing with COVID.
Let's talk about flu a little bit, which we didn't have to do much last year. It was a staggeringly low flu season because of, I think, COVID precautions, but there's concern it might make a comeback. How do we detect a flu versus those allergies or a mild cold?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you hit the nail on the head. Last year, we really didn't deal with a lot of flu. And so a lot of the precautions that we took from COVID, we really saw a decrease in all respiratory viruses, including influenza. I have heard the same thing that you have heard. We're expecting this season to definitely start picking up here soon. With flu, you're going to see a lot of similar symptoms to COVID, right? So fever, chills, muscle aches, along with the runny nose, congested nose, coughing symptoms. And so similar to what I talked about before, if you have new symptoms of runny nose, congested nose, you're still going to err on the side of getting that looked into. You should definitely get that looked into if you have other symptoms as well. You know, you have the fevers, you have the muscle aches with it. If you have anything else with that new runny nose, that's going to really push you over. From a differentiating between the two, as of right now, a lot of the time when people are going in and getting tested, it's just for COVID. We're not really seeing a lot of flu in the community right now. There are ways that when we do viral testing, we can check for multiple different viruses. And so there are a lot of organizations that I believe will be switching to doing a COVID and flu test together when patients go in. And so you could get those results together.
We're talking about the differences between COVID, the flu, colds, and allergies when we start to have various symptoms. Dr. Dylan Timberlake is with us, allergist and immunologist with Prevea Health in Chippewa Falls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been sniffling, coughing, feeling tired, dealing with headaches, are you worried about what you might have? Are you a regular seasonal allergy sufferer like me? Has something worked for you? Do you have a question for our guest about allergies? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about seasonal illnesses and allergies, how to tell them apart, and what to do about them. Fall allergies are out there. COVID is too. Colds making a comeback. And health experts think the flu is likely to return this winter after being virtually non-existent here last year. Dr. Dylan Timberlake stays with us, allergist and immunologist with Prevea Health in Chippewa Falls. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been trying to distinguish these symptoms for yourself? For your kid, do you have questions about allergy seasonality, about the treatments out there, and more? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Eau Claire. Brian, hi.
Hi there. So my question is about treatment of allergies. My son and I both have them. My son pretty bad. And we were doing the shots for a while to build up the immunity, and he didn't like the shots every week, so we switched to the drops. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I'm just wondering how effective are either? Is one better than the other?
Thanks for the call, Brian. Dr. Timberlake?
Yeah, Brian, that's a great question. And it's one that we get a lot. And so obviously, as my general disclaimer for everyone, you know, this is going to be general medical advice for specific questions. You can talk to your allergist or primary care docs about it. But when you look at allergy shots versus allergy drops, which are sublingual drops that go underneath the tongue, the biggest difference I tell people is shots look to be a little bit more effective, but also with a little bit of increased risk in terms of some side effects with those shots, whereas those sublingual drops are still effective treatment options, but typically are a little bit less effective. But then you're also looking at some decreased risk and decreased side effects that go with them. And so really looking and weighing risks and benefits of both and what works best for your individual life and health goals.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call. Good luck to you and your kid. I feel you. I had allergy shots for about 10 years when I was a kid myself. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Timberlake, that reminds me, I know some conditions look different when kids, especially little kids, get them versus adults. Do any of the things we're talking about look different in children than the grown-ups?
No, by and large, a lot of the allergy symptoms we see, cold symptoms, COVID symptoms, look pretty similar between adults and children.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about allergies and how to tell them apart from colds, flus, and, of course, COVID. What is some of the cutting edge right now, Dr. Timberlake, when it comes to allergy treatment?
So when we're talking about environmental allergy treatment, really we're looking at our tried and true things that we've been doing for quite a while, to be honest. And so when I have patients who come in for environmental allergies and we do allergy testing and find out that they're positive, the ways that I talk about treatment options is really three different things. So once we know what you're allergic to, we can talk about avoidance measures, or if you can't avoid those certain types of allergen triggers, we can talk about how to decrease your exposure to those. Your second option is going to be medications. And so we can talk about which medications would work best for you based on what works best for your life and based on also the symptoms you're having. And then the third option, as the last caller had mentioned, is allergy. We call it allergen immunotherapy is by and large the term, but most people know that as allergy shots. And what we do with allergy shots is we expose you to a small amount of what you're allergic to and then slowly increase that over time to essentially make your body immune and realize that you should no longer be reacting to that. And so really, most allergists will look at all three of those treatment options, discuss those with patients, and then try to fit what works best for you and your personal health goals, and then kind of pick a treatment option encompassing all three of those, or two out of the three, or kind of pick what works best for you.
Now, you tweet with the handle @AllergyOnTheRun, and I saw an interesting factoid there. I think a lot of people with allergies have thought, should I go hunting for possible allergens in my yard? If I'm reading your Twitter feed right, I shouldn't really worry so much about that. Why?
I appreciate you looking at that. But so the reason is there was a really interesting study where I think it was the Navy who did it, who they took a ship about 200 to 300 miles offshore and they collected pollen. And what they found was they could still find pollen that was from the shoreline that far out into the water. And so really, you know, if you come in and you have allergy testing and you're allergic to, let's say, a maple tree and oak tree, and you look out in your backyard and you see maple and oak trees, taking down those trees clearly based on that study isn't going to be beneficial for you. That pollen is really light, fluffy. It blows in the wind. And so you're going to be exposed to if it's in the region. And most allergists are only going to test for pollens that are relevant to the region that you're living in.
Okay. And I've heard that you mentioned earlier, actually, that people can grow into allergies. People who didn't have allergies can get them later. Do we ever grow out of them?
Yeah. So allergies can change over time and it can go either way. And so you can have people who didn't have environmental allergies growing up and then develop them in their 20s, 30s, 40s. Most of the time, we don't see people who weren't previously allergic developing allergies into their 50s and 60s, but it can happen. And same thing, there are younger people who have allergies and then just naturally over time, they outgrow those allergies and become less allergic.
Time for one more caller if he's ready. Oh, nope, not queued up yet. Okay. Oh, no, there he is. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask in regard to the shots, why is it not the same when one is exposed to an allergen over decades that you don't build up an immunity to it?
Yeah.
What is different about having shots?
Yeah, I want to know that too.
That's a great, great question. And so what we know is that your body, so when you're allergic to something, it's actually just your body's immune response. And so when we say allergies, we're talking about an immune system response. Your immune system is there to help you to fight off infections. And so your allergic response is actually part of your immune system that helps you to fight off infections. What we know is that if you're exposed to different triggers, different allergens, different, infections in different areas of your body in different modalities, your body is going to respond differently to that. And so with environmental allergens, the reason that we become allergic to them, or I shouldn't say the reason, but the way that we react is all environmental allergens are light and fluffy enough that we breathe them into our nose and that response is happening in your nose. When your body gets exposed to those allergens in a different way. So in our shots, we put them just underneath the skin in something called a subcutaneous injection. When your body sees it that way, your immune response in your subcutaneous area is different than that in your nose, and it learns that it shouldn't respond to that. And then your immune system actually changes so that you have a different type of immune response to those allergens, less of an allergic immune response. And then that will ultimately decrease your allergy symptoms on exposure to those allergens.
Awesome. Great question. Thanks, Mike. And Dr. Timberlake, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Dylan Timberlake is an allergist and immunologist with Prevea Health in Chippewa Falls. We talked to him about the differences between fall allergies, colds, the flu, and COVID, and what we should do when we get symptoms. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Today, we use the word mammoth to talk about things that are really, really big. But the actual thing the word refers to, the prehistoric elephant-like creature, hasn't been around since the end of the last ice age. A new company called Colossal says it wants to grow some new mammoths and introduce them to the melting tundra of Siberia. Can it be done? Should it be done? Beth Shapiro is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's the author of the book, How to Clone a Mammoth. Her forthcoming book, out in about a month, is called Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the science here. And I've been careful not to use the word clone or cloning here, Beth, because as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, this is not cloning they're talking about.
Right. Well, when people think of cloning, the thing that comes to mind first is Dolly, right? Dolly the sheep, this famous clone. But the trick to cloning a mammal, and because we can't clone other things like birds, we just don't have the technology yet. But the trick to cloning is to having a living, is to have a living cell. And for something like a mammoth, where the most recent mammoths died more than 3,000 years ago, we don't have any living cells. So we need different technology if we're going to bring one of these things back to life.
So what is Colossal talking about doing then that's going to make a, at least mammoth-like creature?
In my field, which is called ancient DNA, we have learned that we can go out into the tundra and we can find frozen bones and teeth and, you know, sometimes entire mummified bodies of mammoths, and they have DNA in them. They don't have any living cells, but they have DNA. It's all broken down and chewed up and in tiny pieces, but we can extract it and then take these billions or trillions of fragments and gradually, slowly piece them together to make the whole sequence of a mammoth's genome. And then on a computer, we can compare that to an elephant's genome and figure out all the places that they're different. So what Colossal are thinking of doing is using that sequence that we have on a computer that we learned by looking at mammoth DNA and living cells from elephants. Asian elephants are the closest living relative of mammoths, and gene editing technologies like CRISPR, and then gradually tweaking the DNA in those living elephant cells until the genome in there, the DNA code, looks like that from a mammoth. And then, voila, you've got a living mammoth-ish cell.
Okay, so we got a cell. Yeah, what do we do with that cell?
Well, then the step is to clone it. That would be the same technology. We take that cell, we trick it into forgetting all the instructions to be whatever type of cell it is. Normally, in a dish in the lab, it's a skin cell or a muscle cell or something like that. But it has to forget those instructions and then revert into the type of cell that can start to divide and become all the different cell types that make up a whole animal. And once that has happened, we then can have a little embryo that's developing in a cell, and you could implant that into a surrogate host. So this is another place that Colossal's stumbled across a problem and a potential solution. The problem here is elephants. No one's ever done IVF on an elephant successfully. There's, you know, plus, I mean, ethically, it's a little problematic, right? Like if we can do this for elephants, we should probably be making more elephants rather than using surrogate elephant moms to make mammoths, right? Or something mammoth-like. We can get into that too. But so what they've decided they're going to do is invent an artificial womb for an elephant, you know, like a big giant robotic womb that can bring these embryos somehow all the way to term. Elephants have an almost 2-year gestation too. So this would be a really smart robot that knew how to do lots of things in developmental biology that we don't really know how to do yet. And this is technology we don't have, right? But, you know, think big, right? Mammoth-like. Think colossally. Oh, that was too much, right?
Now, okay, suppose we overcome, or Colossal overcomes these technological hurdles, and you've got a baby mammoth-ish creature. My understanding of modern-day elephants is they're very strong parental bonds, or at least maternal bonds. If I'm raising a baby mammoth without a mama mammoth, is that something I'd really call a mammoth without that social upbringing in its life?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing about clones, right? We know from research all over the place that we are more than the A's and C's and G's and T's, those DNA letters that make up our genomes. All of us know clones, right? Do you know identical twins?
Very well, because I have a pair of them.
Oh, there you go. Well, they're clones, right? But they're different. They're different from each other. Right? And so just because you have something that's genetically identical doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be. And those differences, they start early on. You know, if an Asian elephant and a mammoth We know that there are about 1.5 million differences in their DNA code that differentiate them. That's about the same as between us and chimpanzees, right? So how would we take something, even if it's been gene edited to look like one of these species or the other, and put it in that other species to develop, or into a robot where we don't really understand what the triggers are to turn genes on and off or up and down and really have this developmental process go? And then, as you say, it's born. And how does it learn to act? How does it learn to be that species? And, you know, this is part of the problem. Elephants also do this thing called coprophagy, where the mom feeds the baby a little bit of her own poop so that the community of microorganisms that they need to digest their food gets established in their guts. Now, we have no idea if having a mammoth community of microorganisms is really different than having an elephant community of microorganisms, but you presume it is to some extent. And whether that has any difference in what the animal looks like, I mean, we just don't know. And then elephants have these tight bonds, not just maternal bonds, but really community level bonds. You know, they're very social animals and they wander around. There's no reason to suspect that a mammoth wouldn't have been the same. And, you know, their goal is not to create one, but to actually create populations of animals that have all the different biological sexes and or both biological sexes, and then all the different all of the different generation times. So you have grandparents and parents and young ones, et cetera, to teach them how to act and to behave and to move around and to find resources and to interact with the other things in their habitats. And those aren't going to exist. They for a long time in the wild, elephants, I think it takes at least until their teenage years for them to become reproductively mature. So if you think about what it might take to have several generations of mammoths that are a population that can wander around the tundra and do all of these things that Colossal and the scientists working there are imagining that they're going to do, it's going to take a long time, even if we were to get over all of these technical hurdles relatively quickly. And by that, I think they're saying, you know, 6 years to 10 years or so for an artificial womb and a baby mammoth.
We're talking about a company planning to bring back a new version of the extinct woolly mammoth. Beth Shapiro is with us, author of books, including How to Clone a Mammoth and the forthcoming Life as We Made It. Beth, I'll wave a magic wand. All the technology problems are solved. Should we do it? Should we bring back woolly mammoths?
Well, this is a difficult question. So their argument is that woolly mammoths they probably played a really important role in their landscape, right? And because we know that elephants do in the landscape that they are, and they're arguing that if you have all of these big mammals around, they're going to wander around the tundra and they're going to remove snow from the surface of the ground during the winter. And snow is a very efficient insulator, right? So if you remove snow, then the cold Arctic winter air hits that ground and it freezes it more thoroughly. And there are scientists up in northeastern Siberia at a place called Pleistocene Park who've done some experiments and shown that when you have large mammals on the landscape, the dirt, the permafrost, the frozen dirt under the ground stays colder than if you don't have it there. And so they're arguing that if you put these animals back on the landscape, you can keep all that carbon and methane that's trapped in the permafrost there rather than spitting it out into the atmosphere to contribute to global warming. This, to me, feels a little bit far-fetched. I mean, you would need a lot of animals to do this, and I don't think that we should be focusing on this as our solution to the climate crisis. We obviously need other solutions other than this. But if we are thinking about putting something back on the landscape that does have a particular ecological role, maybe it's spreading around nutrients or distributing seeds or helping that ecosystem to regenerate these services that were lost when the animal went extinct, then maybe there's some reason to do it. I argue that we are never going to see something that's identical to a mammoth, but we don't really need something that's identical to a mammoth if we just need something that can perform those roles, those services that the mammoth once provided. And to me, this is why I like to think about the technology. And this is one of the reasons I'm actually genuinely excited about the investment into Colossal and really thinking about developing technologies where we're using these new biotechnologies maybe not to bring species back that are gone, but anything that they develop along the way, all of the resources for doing multiple edits, even artificial wombs, really understanding how the genomes of organisms that we don't normally have in a lab look and act, these have immediate payoffs for biodiversity conservation of things that are still alive. And it's so hard to get investment into biodiversity conservation. People would argue that, you know, any money that we get that we put into this kind of work, there's a fantastic nonprofit called Revive and Restore that's out of Sausalito near San Francisco in California that have been involved with a project to introduce genetic diversity into populations of black-footed ferrets, right? So black-footed ferrets, they thought were extinct, and then they found a population that was still alive, but they don't have very much genetic diversity. And when they release them into the wild, they get sylvatic plague from eating prairie dogs and they die. And so one of the solutions to this is to introduce genetic diversity from other black-footed ferrets, if they existed, or potentially from species like the domestic ferret, which is a cousin of theirs, but that is genetically immune to plague. And Revive and Restore have been involved with a project with San Diego Zoo, where a few months ago, a kit was born, a baby blackfoot ferret that was cloned from cells that were preserved frozen at the San Diego Zoo for around 40 years. So resurrecting genetic diversity from the past to introduce into this population, really dramatically increasing their diversity and potentially their chance to survive in their captive environment. And they're now working with Fish and Wildlife and some other organizations to identify what it is in domestic ferrets that makes them resistant to plague, to potentially use that technology to move traits between species using gene editing. These are really cool new biotechnological solutions for biodiversity preservation, not de-extinction, biodiversity preservation, like addressing a crisis that we have right now. And the investment into companies like Colossal is new money into conservation that's going to have such tremendous benefits for conservation. I think it's really exciting.
Beth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us and hope to talk to you about your new book in not too long.
Thanks.
That's Beth Shapiro, professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of the book How to Clone a Mammoth and the forthcoming book I just mentioned, Life as We Made It. We talked to her today about a new company trying to do the title of her older book, Clone, or not effectively recreate mammoths, and whether it's a good or even ethical idea.